There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We've bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it? The other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots, independent media, and our media environment. My name is Paul Eastman, I'm your host. Producer Drew Tirico's at the controls. On today's program, we're going to be wrapping up the Republican National Convention. We're going to hear from Sarah from Free103.9.org about the web stream that they ran for pretty much 6 days straight, bringing 24-hour coverage of what was going on in the streets of New York. We'll hear about the travails of an Urbanishing IMC reporter who was arrested and held in custody for almost 2 days. And then we'll also hear a little bit about IMC New York and the Secret Service. Do stay tuned. Free103.9.org is a streaming radio station that took part of with the A Noise Collective to bring full-time streaming radio to the web, telling people what was going on in the streets during the Republican National Convention. And Sarah from Free103.9.org is on the phone with us. Hello, Sarah. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what did you do with the Free103.9 and A Noise Collective stream?
Well, I'm a staff member at Free103.9. I've been involved with that organization for about a year. As you may or may not know, Free103.9 is a transmission arts organization that does all kinds of things to support artists and other people who use transmission media in their daily lives and in their artistic practice. So I come from a background of doing a lot of micro radio in Seattle, Washington, where I'm from, and I came to Free103 with the desire to kind of use those that history that I had. And I guess I started talking with other micro radio people in Brooklyn months and months ago about the idea of doing some live coverage of the Republican National Convention. So what ended up happening was much, much grander than any of the things that we had envisioned at that point. We ended up creating a web stream, essentially, that carried live reporting, but then also pre-recorded interviews and sound pieces and music and kind of, you know, roundtable discussions and all kinds of things that happened with some forethought, but also a lot of them very, very spontaneously. So the web stream was put out from many, many websites and rebroadcast all over the world by micro radio people and also by licensed radio people. And so it ended up being a really exciting collaborative project. What I was doing was, boy, I did a lot of things. I was on the street making reports about some of the things I was seeing in New York City. I pre-recorded a lot of interviews with people who had interesting insight about what was going on in the world. I helped set up a redundant studio to make sure that if our studio A went down, we'd have other options for how to broadcast. And stuck around the studio a little bit, hosting and taking calls and doing interviews.
So was the studio set up specifically for doing the A Noise RNC coverage?
It was, and a really, really remarkable thing about the studio is that we got almost everything. We got everything we did done with no money. The Inverse
Wow.
Coalition didn't do any fundraisers. Not that we wouldn't have if we had, you know, had the time. But we ended up getting a whole lot of stuff donated, from PCs and audio equipment to domain hosting and all kinds of different things. So, yeah, the studio was set up. It was ready to go about 3 days before we started streaming. And it was purely a spontaneous, eruptive product.
Wow, and I listened to a lot of it off the web feed, and I mean, my impression of it is it sounded really put together very well, and it was very amazing. It was pretty much wall-to-wall, and for the 6 days, from about Saturday to yesterday, like even overnight, things would come on, you'd run some music, or you had DJ sets going on, you know, sometimes at night, but then you'd still come in with reports in the street, so you had a phone line and the ability to take calls.
Well, part of that happened because of a collaboration with the indie media convergence space. Indie media here in New York set up a large media convergence space that was actually donated on the 13th floor of an office building, and there was space for public computer use. There was space for print journalists to work. There was space for video, and then there was our sound studio. So one of the great things about being involved at that space was that we got access to the dispatchers who were taking calls from the outside world and patching them through to our sound studio and to the other areas where the calls might need to be routed. So we were able to set up an IRC, like a chat room, several chat rooms actually, but a kind of a backline chat room where while we were in the studio broadcasting, we could see from dispatchers what kind of calls were coming in, and then we could pay attention to them with some kind of preparation.
And you pretty much, I mean, aired phone calls from people on the streets who may have been, you know, have even in the middle of being confronted by police. You aired them live and uncensored, pretty much.
Of course, yeah. I don't think we would have done it any other way. I don't know. I don't feel a lot of motivation myself to put a ton of energy behind projects where expression is going to be squelched in any way. And that's kind of why I've personally been interested in functioning outside of the purview of the FCC.
And so now when you said you're functioning outside the purview of the FCC, but the ANOIS, I mean, you were not operating a transmitter yourselves, correct?
No. No, in that case, we're operating outside of the purview of the FCC because they haven't figured out a way to regulate internet radio yet. I'm sure that there's enough money in it that there'll be future attempts to regulate, but currently it's limited only kind of by your capacity to stream. And so, by providing a web stream that could be picked up by people who were either, web streaming themselves or broadcasting FM or broadcasting unlicensed FM, we did something that was completely legal and that could be used in many, many different ways by people who wanted to remain legal and people who didn't have so much concern about regulations.
Do you know about how many unlicensed stations picked up your stream?
You know, that's the beautiful thing about a decentralized global media network, but I really don't have any idea. I mean, I know how many I'm aware of, but there's going to be more information coming in about, you know, people that we don't even know about that might have picked it up and picked up the stream and rebroadcast it. So I know that in New York there were probably about 7 frequencies that used the stream in Manhattan, not all running continuously, but I think we were on about 7 frequencies in Manhattan, and then a number more in Brooklyn, and then I've been hearing about people rebroadcasting it in other parts of the country and the world.
And did you get responses from anyone from outside the U.S.?
Oh, absolutely. We were taking calls from people in Amsterdam, in the U.K., Canada, many other places, Spain.
And did you get much negative feedback, or were you getting any crank phone calls or complaints?
You know, remarkably few. I think what we got more of was over-enthusiastic phone calls, people who were, like, so thrilled at the moment they were in. They were just, you know, wanted to hold up their cell phones to the massive noise that was rushing at them, and sometimes it was hard to, you know, decipher what was going on from the phone calls. But we got, I mean, remarkably enough, escaped censure, I think, in most ways. I think more what we, as far as criticism, more of what we got was kind of like, you know, people within the activist movement you know, offering ideas about how things should be done, but we didn't get much, like, kind of, you know, world-at-large criticism.
Wow, considering that you were giving out the phone number pretty much perpetually, and obviously in New York it would have been at least seven frequencies where people could tune in all over the city, that's pretty amazing that you got mostly a positive response. And you said you were personally out doing reportage on the street.
Oh, yeah.
And so what was that experience like? What was it like on the streets in New York this past week?
Wow, I mean, we definitely don't have time to even enumerate the
sure.
even the beginning of all the things that were happening in New York.
There
it was an absolutely thrilling atmosphere, I think. Some of those things, let's see, I was at, one of the high points for me was, it was a relatively mild event compared to many of the huge clashes that occurred, but I really, really enjoyed Reverend Billy and the First Amendment Choir at St. Mark's Church. Reverend Billy is the leader of the Church of Stop Shopping, and he, during his everyday life, he and his church members do actions that are like old school revivals, and they will head into like a Starbucks or a Macy's or a corporate sales area and repent against the evils of shopping. You know, they kind of fill up their carts and then cast down the things they've selected and cleanse themselves of the evils of shopping. And they had a really incredible First Amendment choir and rally at St. Mark's Church where a whole lot of people gathered and learned the First Amendment and said it with one voice, and it was thrilling. I also was lucky enough to be at some of the larger marches. I really, really enjoyed the Poor People's March, the Stilly Rise March. A lot being addressed that still isn't on the agenda for any of the major political speakers. And then the other thing that I found pretty thrilling during the week was the mouse block, which, the legend about how one little mouse can scare a giant elephant. Well, there were a number of people who collected themselves into a mouse block and kind of disrupted the pleasure of Republicans who were attending Broadway shows.
So do you feel that it was successful, the coverage and the web stream that you put on?
Oh, I feel like I'm pretty amazed and thrilled at what came of our efforts. I think it was pretty extraordinary. But the thing that I think is the most extraordinary is that all the people involved have formed the type of relationships that I think are going to last. And there's this thing that happens when people work really, really hard together in times of uncertainty and trauma. It's just like a really, it's a joyful and thrilling kind of bond. And I really look forward to the future of collaboration in New York.
Sarah, thank you very much for putting on the stream and your work there, and also thank you very much for joining us here on Media Geek.
Thank you. Can I list off some websites?
Yeah, please do.
If people want to look at the website that we have been using, it's no longer streaming live, but it might again, you can look at anoise.net or anoise.org. I'd also encourage you to visit the New York City IMC website and 3103.9.org. And that's it's the word free, the number 103, the word point, the number 9, and .org.
Great. Thanks again, Sarah.
Take care now.
And you are listening to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media and our media environment. My name is Paul Reese, and I'm your host. And Drew Tirico is our producer. He's at the controls. Today we're doing kind of a rundown of the week's events, especially things that happened in New York City. Protesters were protesting en masse, up to 500,000 people on Sunday, the Republican National Convention. And then there were actions going on all week long. And as well, there was lots of indie media there to cover it. And in fact, there were five journalists from the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center who were at the RNC, and they were arrested on Tuesday, August 31st, while walking on the sidewalk. Much later, they were charged with parading without a permit and civil disobedience. One of these reporters is Colleen Cook. Now, to get out of jail, she accepted an ACD, which stands for Adjourned Contemplating Dismissal, which means that if she is not arrested in New York in the next 6 months, the charges will be dropped as if the arrest had never happened. Now, most of the detainees accepted this plea because it's low on hassle, but many who pleaded innocent before a judge found their charges were dropped based on lack of evidence. The ACD, however, does allow Colleen and the others to file class action lawsuits for wrongful arrest and mistreatment. But one of the probably the most awful parts of being arrested in New York City over this past week was the Pier 57, dubbed Little Guantanamo, because it was an ad hoc remodeled bus depot, overcrowded, full of protesters and other people who were just swept up on the street. And many people who were swept up in these arrests where the cops had penned them in were reporters or tourists or just bystanders who just had to be walking through and then got arrested and then shipped off to Pier 57 in Lower Manhattan. We've heard from many reporters and arrestees that the floor was covered with a greasy sludge that contain chemicals you might expect to find on the floor of a bus depot, like diesel fuel or antifreeze or motor
oil.
Oil
and really toxic chemicals.
And some police officers are even suing the city of New York for the conditions in which they were forced to work. And the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center kept touch with all of the reporters through the time in which they're arrested and even through the time they're detained due to some smuggled-in cell phones. And all that audio got published to the Urbana-Champaign IMC website at www.ucimc.org. We can't play it all here, but you can definitely go listen to it online. But now we're going to hear a little bit of Colleen's experiences as told to Ellen Knutson, who was at the Urbana IMC yesterday.
When we were first called by the police, the whole thing seemed so silly because we were actually on the sidewalk and not weaving in between cars, you know, normal protest concept. We're actually behaving really, really well.
Uh-huh.
So the whole thing seemed so silly that I don't think even when they said that they were going to arrest everyone, and there were so many of us, that it just didn't make any sense. So we all just kind of didn't take it seriously. And I don't know, it just seems completely absurd for being arrested for being on the sidewalk. And so even when it got to the point of handcuffs, it still seemed kind of funny because I just thought they would kind of let us go. So when we got on the buses, that changed things a little bit. The officer that we had was pretty fair for the most part. I mean, he was nice to us. He made sure our handcuffs fit us well and, you know, weren't hurting us or anything, and told us he was going to try and get us out pretty quickly, while at the same time preaching to us, which other officers told us was cruel and unusual punishment, and we couldn't agree more. But when we arrived to the pier, it was kind of, it was a warehouse that seemed like it was set up within like the last 20 minutes, just like they weren't expecting anything. And I don't know, it was very hastily assembled, I guess. And there were these metal pens that, seemed more, not like a space for humans or dogs or animals, just like stuff you put boxes in.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know it at the time, but those would later be the pens that we would be in.
Uh-huh.
And so we had to, like, go through this horrible maze of getting our stuff taken from us, my vinegar that we were going to be using to combat against tear gas was taken away as evidence. And I had no idea what charges would be filed against me as a result of it. But when we were put in these pens, by the end, like, on and off throughout the night, we were largely the first group to arrive there. There were about 450 of us. And we were separated, men and women. And the women's cage or pen, at one point in the night, there was over 90 women in a 40 by 20 foot cage.
Uh-huh.
And then when we actually got so overcrowded that one of the police chiefs made them open what it was a 20 by 40 foot cell that we were all in, and then there was another like separate cell that was attached to it and that the bathrooms were in. So it was like two doors basically for us to get out. And so then when it became so overcrowded, the officer had them open the second cell door so we could lay on the floor to go to sleep next to the bathroom to the portalist. So we couldn't, not everyone could obviously lay down, much less sit down. And it was so filthy you really didn't want to. I mean, just like incredibly filthy. It wasn't dirt that you could wipe off. It just stuck to you and stayed on. And some girls would like resort to like stealing like strips of cardboard and putting them down on the ground. It really didn't do any good. I did develop a rash from stuff on the floor, and so I've seen the medics, and The situation was really, really, really inhumane, and I found it pretty surprising because you just expect, I guess, certain things nowadays. And ironically enough, I saw the Statue of Liberty for the first time in my life from behind prison bars when you'd look out the fire escape. So that was really sad. And by the end of the night, everyone was so exhausted that they just, like, would throw their bodies down on the ground. It was just really sad and very disturbing because it was just a very disgusting and uncomfortable situation. And we had really bright lights on us the entire night, so it was impossible to sleep, and they were always opening and closing the cages, bringing more girls in. And it was a very unpleasant night, to say the least. So it was very nice when we were able to get to a payphone and talk to you guys at the IMC to hear that, you know, there was a possibility that we were getting out, that we had been arraigned, because this was all information that we couldn't get from anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And a lot of girls really have no hope at all, because the whole situation was so silly that, I mean, the very fact that we were arrested for walking on the sidewalk,
yeah.
I mean, it made everything seem like anything was possible, like that we would not ever be released, which, when you're hungry and tired and haven't slept, you know, you don't know.
And that is Colleen Cook, a Urbana-Champaign IMC reporter who was arrested for walking on the sidewalk on August 31st and was detained for over a day out at Pier 57, which you just heard about. There's much more information about this, including a feature article at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center website, www.ucimc.org. And you can also see information about the more global situation of what was going on in New York at nyc.indymedia.org. And speaking of New York Indie Media, as we mentioned in the teaser top of the show, they found out that the Secret Service and the Department of Justice opened a criminal investigation and is demanding records concerning anti-RNC delegate posts to their website. Specifically, the Department of Justice is seeking information on lists of 2,200 RNC delegate names posted to their Open Newswire. And like all indie media sites, the Open Newswire is a place where anyone can come and post news of any kind. It is not edited, nor is it at all vetted before it goes up on to the website. Chris Anderson spoke with Tariq Karula, who's part of the A Noise Collective, about this situation the other day.
The reason they're doing this is in reference to a post to our Open Publishing Newswire that contained the names, and I believe at least some of the contact information, but at least the names, of about half the delegates that are in New York right now attending the Republican National Convention. It was a list of 2,200 names that was anonymously posted to our Open Publishing Newswire.
Now, this sounds actually familiar because it has happened before, right?
It's happened at least once before that I know of. Tariq, you may actually know of other times, but at least once in Quebec City after the FTAA protests there, I believe in 2000 or 2001, there was a subpoena issued pretty much for the exact same information, trying to somehow figure out the identity of a person who had posted information to Indie Media's Open Publishing Wire.
And just to clarify, Indie Media, New York City Independent Media Center, as well as IndieMedia.org runs a website that has an open publishing system?
Correct.
So how does that work?
Well, basically, anyone, anywhere, anytime can upload and publish journalistic news to our wire, stories, written stories, photographs, video, audio of an event that they think going around in New York, an event they think might be important. They can do that anonymously if they so choose. You know, we do encourage people, if they feel that they have nothing to hide, to post their name if they'd like. But, you know, publishing to the New York IMC is anonymous. We have a pretty relaxed policy in terms of what people can post. We do have publishing guidelines for the site, so if you violate those guidelines, your post may be hidden. But generally, you know, New York Indie Media is a pretty free-flowing forum for news and opinion.
I think it was after the Quebec incident that, I'm not sure if you know about this, that the system administrators on the servers decided to stop keeping IP addresses.
Yes, I do know about that, and that's one of the things that makes this whole investigation ironic. First of all, I mean, New York Indie Media feels that this subpoena and this investigation harkens back to the bad of the bad, the worst of the bad old days under Richard Nixon, when subpoena power was basically used by the federal government as a way to harass and intimidate and go after political enemies. We think that that's exactly what John Ashcroft and the rest of the Bush administration is doing in this case. They know they have no case against us. They are simply looking to scare us and to scare RISP. So that's the first thing. But, however, even if we didn't think that, and even if we wanted to give them the information they're asking, we couldn't because we don't collect any of the information they want. So it's kind of a fairly pointless exercise. There's really nothing we could do to provide them with what they're looking for, even if we wanted to, which we don't.
So an internet service provider is a web server that hosts a website. When you go and visit a website in your browser, when you bring up Yahoo or when you bring up Indie Media, you're actually going out over the network, the internet, to a server that's hosted somewhere in the world. And in this case, the server for NYC Indie Media is hosted at a service provider called Calyx. Now, those servers also run a logging system and can collect information about visitors that are coming to visit the site. And one of those pieces of information is something called an IP address. And an IP address is simply a number, sort of like a telephone number, that represents the viewer that came to the site. And it was after Quebec that administrators on the servers decided to stop keeping that information in case that ever came up again.
Correct. No matter how this turns out, I think this is a really, really important and sort of informative lesson for everyone out there. I think we still have a fairly utopian view of the internet. Because it is, you know, a very, very free medium, relatively speaking. But I think there is this understanding or this assumption that the internet is wild and free and will be wild and free forever, and there's nothing that anyone could ever do to stop it.
And that is Chris Anderson of the New York City Independent Media Center speaking to Tariq Karula, who is with the A-Noise Radio Collective. That's an interview they did on the A-Noise stream talking about current investigation by the Department of Justice into posts made to the New York City IMC website regarding some of the delegates to the RNC. And, of course, you can get more information about that at the MediaGeek website, MediaGeek.org, and at the New York City IMC website, NYC.IndieMedia.org. And, Drew, you do have an update on Martel Miller, who was our guest last week.
That's right. He's our local independent journalist, Martel Miller. We spoke with him last week. And he's been charged with yet another count of eavesdropping after Champaign police reviewed his video footage of police officers making traffic stops. The videotape with footage of police was held from broadcasting on Urbana Public Television August 22nd, seized from UPTV on August 26th, and not formally subpoenaed until September 1st. Miller is a founding member of VIA, which is Visionaries Educating Youths and Adults, a local organization devoted to education of youth and adults in the community. The group has held a forum with community members attended by Champaign police and has been trying to point out that police look to a small group of leaders to speak for the entire community. VIA has more information on their website at www.via.org about this case. And you can listen to last week's conversation that we had with Martel, of course, on the MediaGeek website, which is MediaGeek.org. Miller's court date, and this is important, has been set for September 8th at 3:30 at the Champaign County Courthouse. So we at MediaGeek hope to see you all there. That's September 8th.
And I do just want to clarify for anyone who didn't hear the interview last week and that we were speaking to Martel because he'd been charged already with one count of felony eavesdropping because he is recording public traffic stops on videotape, or was recording public traffic stops on videotape out in public on the street as police were stopping folks, mostly in the north end of Champaign, which is a predominantly black area of Champaign, and was charged with eavesdropping for essentially using a video recorder in public, recording things that are going on in public, just like any other reporter would do. So once again, his court date is September 8th at 3:30 p.m. at the Champaign County Courthouse. And certainly anyone who is concerned about the rights of anyone to be a reporter and to record what is going on in their community, to report to people what is really going on, what doesn't get seen, may want to show up there and lend some support to Martel. That brings us to the close of another edition of Media Geek. We'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media and our media environment. In the meantime, you can catch up with independent media news at the Media Geek website, www.mediageek.org. There you can also download and listen to the archive editions of the program in MP3 in the open source Ogg Vorbis format.
Media Geek is produced live at the studios of Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some pre-production happens at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. Media Geek's producer is Drew Tirico, and I'm Paul Riesmandel. The Media Geek radio show is free to rebroadcast by non-commercial stations for non-profit purposes. Please contact us for permission to excerpt. Email me at paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.